Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. Our website is redicecreations.com. We have over 1 year of free radio available for you in our archive. Interviews with interesting people doing important work into alternative research subject matters like geopolitics, conspiracy history, even esoteric and occult topics, and much, much more. You can also sign up for a membership on our website to get access to our films, webcasts, video interviews, and of course our entire radio archive with both hours going back to 2006. All information is available on redicecreations.com. And I'm glad you tuned in today and decided to join us. We have Catherine Austin Fitz with us on the line, and she is a former commissioner at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in the first Bush administration. She's currently the president of Solari.com that primarily focuses on economic and investment issues. And she joins us today to discuss her views on the swine flu issue. And I also want to talk with her a little bit about the current economic situation and kind of how we've ended up here as it is. The website you can take a look at right away is Solari.com. That's more on the Solari report and more information about Catherine and her work. So with that, it's a pleasure to have you with us today, Catherine. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be doing so.
Excellent. We have many things to discuss here, and I think one thing we need to do here right away, so to speak, is if you briefly just can tell us a little bit about your background for our listeners that might not be familiar with you and your work, and also, if you can, when you decided to start up your website, Solari.com.
Sure. I was a partner and member of the board of Dillon Reed, which was a Wall Street firm. And in 1989, I left Wall Street to become Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration. And then when I left, started a investment bank in Washington, the Hamilton Securities Group. It was very much focused on helping private investors work with communities to re-engineer how the flow of investment capital worked in communities in a way that would significantly build up small business, small farms. It's a little bit of investment model behind decentralization, or what some people call localization. And that was very successful, but one of the things we were doing was bringing transparency to how government money and credit worked in communities. And what that did was illuminate tremendous amounts of fraud in the mortgage securities and the mortgage financing in the United States. And as a result, we were targeted in a process that turned into 11 years of litigation with the federal government. And that, you know, I was a financial person who was always very invisible and behind the scenes. And that brought me into a situation where the only way I could resolve the litigation successfully was to bring transparency, not just to my situation, but what sort of the corruption in the mortgage markets and in the financial markets. And so I ended up launching two companies. One is Solari Inc., which really brings, we're trying to help families and individuals protect wealth in a situation where it's we're dealing with more and more sort of government corruption. And then the other is Solari Investment Advisors. I work as an investment advisor to individuals and families. And so my history has been one of trying to help people who want to be free and want to be financially secure and want to live in wonderful communities, try and navigate an environment where here in the United States it's increasingly more difficult to do.
Yes. And this is something I definitely want to touch upon more here later in the program. But one thing I'd like to begin to discuss here with you is that you made some pretty interesting comments on your blog at Solari.com a while back and expressed your views very candidly about what you believe about the swine flu issue and the subsequent vaccination programs that now is going into effect almost worldwide. And this is something like that I'd like to ask you a little bit about, considering your situation. You've been involved in politics and so forth, and you're a former insider, so to speak. So it's kind of interesting to hearing about this from your perspective. What can you say about the swine flu issue and the vaccination programs that are going on now?
Sure. And let me just say as background, if there's anyone who is not expert to speak on a health matter, it's me.
Okay, yeah, that's good to say.
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a I'm a lay person when it comes to any health issue, and but obviously interested in that. I'm interested in my health and my family's health. What the reason I commented on the swine flu is I have discovered as an investment advisor that one of the most significant contributors to the absence of financial security for people here in North America is health problems. And I have in my network more than a few people who are struggling with Lyme disease, chronic fatigue, autism in their children, and on and on and on. And that's caused me to research and look deeply into the health system. And I've come to the conclusion, the same conclusion in health as many other fields, which is there's been tremendous suppression of knowledge and technology, which is necessary if we're going to have a cost economic health system. And also that the here in the United States, the government cannot be trusted to act in the best interest of the citizens. The same thing I saw in the mortgage markets or in budgeting and appropriation areas hold true in health. So I'm deeply concerned as just someone interested in helping families preserve wealth about helping families preserve their health, because the two are intimately connected to each other. You cannot preserve your wealth if your mind isn't clear and your body isn't strong and
yes.
clean.
Yes.
So it was with that background that I approached the swine flu issue. Now let me tell you another issue. I do a lot with what I call mapping financial ecosystems. So when I try to understand what's going on around me, whether it's in my community, whether it's in my state, whether it's here in North America, whether it's globally, what I try and do is I map what's happening financially and economically around events, and ask the question, who benefits?
Yes.
You know, qui bono. Who wins, who loses, why? Because so much of our world and our economy is driven by covert events or events or manipulations which are, for a variety of reasons, invisible. I mean, having worked at high levels on Wall Street and Washington, the most planning and governance of the resources in our world is done quietly, and it's done behind the scenes, not in a way, I'm saying, not necessarily in a way that's improper. It's just the way currently it works. So when I, my experience in Wall Street and Washington is the last place to learn about what's going on is in the newspaper
yeah.
or certainly in the corporate media. The corporate media is there to push its agenda, but it's not a source of information about what's really going on. And so whenever I hear of events that are important, impact me, impact my network, I publish something called the Solari Report, Impact My Subscribers. The first thing I do is I map out the financial ecosystems around the event to try and see who wins and who loses and help discern what's going on. Well, if you map the financial ecosystems around the economy in America for the last, well, we'll focus on the last 20 years, we've had an economy which I call is the slow burn. And in a slow burn, the insiders basically use a variety of different force, both visible and invisible, to subsidize themselves with the monies and the resources of the outsiders. It's kind of one expression I have for it is the tapeworm economy. The way a tapeworm it works in your body, it injects in you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're literally, you know, the body politic has a tapeworm, and that tapeworm is getting more and more expensive. And what you'll see with this sort of slow burn economy is every time you get to the point where financial assets should fall in value, so the stock market should fall in value or bond prices should fall in value, rather than have that happen, we have an event. So coming into September 11, 2001, you had all sorts of people in the financial world predicting, oh, the market's going to crash, the jig is up. And instead of that happening, we had September 11th, and suddenly the Fed was able and the Treasury were able to intervene massively in the economy.
Yes.
In a way that kept the financial paper invaluable. So what we've seen steadily is it's like a body that's on steroids, and we keep getting these injections of events. And coming into this September, we were seeing the same pattern. The economy was, unemployment in the United States is skyrocketing. The boomers, as they age, are being told that their pension funds, their 401ks, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all these things they were counting on are being lost or cut. And you looked at this fall and you said, oh, well, something has to, you know, give.
Yeah.
We're either going to get real, you know, another round of tremendous crashes in the economy, or we're going to have another one of these, you know, 9/11, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq. We need a big event. And it was just then. So the financial ecosystems are flashing, warning, 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 event, big event coming, big event needed if we're going to continue to, if the tapeworm's going to continue to extract another round of subsidy. You know, hungry tapeworm on the prowl, and then suddenly the swine flu, started to circulate, and the idea of having a mandatory vaccine. And so that said to me, uh-oh, this needs to be looked at.
Yes.
And then I have a group of doctors and other people I turn to for healthcare information. And what was amazing to me was every one of them was adamant. This vaccine is dangerous. It's a killer. I've never seen such an accord in their information and messages. And, you know, and I'm a great believer, if you don't have a lot of expertise in an area, you know, find people you trust, and then, you know, when you get enough consensus, then you've got, you know, a pretty probable piece of information. Anyway, so the combination of the financial ecosystems flashing danger, 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 and the all the healthcare practitioners and experts I know flashing danger, 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 said to me, you know, we need to look at this, and I need to say something now, so that my network knows that this is something they need to look at and think about. Because if you're a busy person, you know, you need time to understand what this is, how it might work, and what the exemptions are for a vaccine.
Yeah.
And what you need to do if you're gonna try and get an exemption or avoid a mandatory exemption. So what I was trying to do with my article was basically say very, very clearly to my networks and my readers and my subscribers, you need to pay attention now because something dirty is coming down, and this is something that's going to take a little bit of your time to figure out and be prepared for, and you need to do it. Because I will tell you, if you look at a, you know, somebody that I feel responsible for, who has a good job, who's financially secure, who, you know, has a happy family, are hardworking, responsible, disciplined, a vaccine can destroy that family. Mm. And they have. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, they can destroy the health of a child in a way that wreaks havoc with the family emotionally and financially.
Yes.
They can kill a parent. So if just as a financial person feeling responsible for my readers financially, then what I have to say is you can't afford to assume that this vaccine is safe, because we have something here that could destroy our families.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so
yes, and I also want to add this to the mix here, so to speak, that major pharmaceutical companies are now reporting already that they're going to make major profits with these vaccination programs, like Merck Novartis, Baxter, GlaxoSmithKline, and others. What do you think that says about the current state of things?
Well, when you get an economy, we are on a planet that does not have an economic problem. We have a political problem. And, you know, think of this as many years ago when you had these huge dinosaurs roaming the world, and they basically destroyed their financial or their ecosystem because the planet couldn't support, you know, animals that hungry and that big. So we have a similar situation with big corporations that are, we've built up, for example, in the healthcare industry, tremendous industry overhead that we can't afford. It was built up as a result of massive amounts of government debt, and it's not economic when you said, if you were just going to devise a health system to optimize living well-being of all the people, the current system is not economic. And part of that industry overhead is these huge corporations making significant amount of drugs and selling them for way above cost. So you've got corporations, they need, you know, they're a tapeworm, they need to be fed, and yes, they're going to make a tremendous amount of money, including because here in the United States, the federal government has waived all their liabilities, so they have absolutely no liability on this thing, is my understanding. Now, but I don't think the goal here is to make money, because usually what happens in decision making at this level, you know, where you're going to, you know, where people are going to decide to have a vaccination worldwide, is a group of people get together thinking strategically and decide where they want to go. And so then the next decision is, okay, now that we know we want to go to this place, how can we organize it so all the organizations we need to get to that place make money?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the making of the money is not the strategic goal. It's the thing that makes accomplishing that strategic goal financially sustainable. So, yes, I think it's been designed so it'll be very attractive for the drug companies to execute, and will continue to subsidize that part of the tapeworm. But I don't think making money is the goal on this thing. I think, you know, who knows? There could be many, many different goals, but I think none of them are good for the people who take the vaccination.
Well, that's right. And another thing I was thinking about here, recently came out a news item about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that they actually sold their total holding of about 2.5 million shares in various healthcare companies and so forth, and they bought shares, I think, in telecom and energy or whatever. But do you think that's significant or not? Does that say anything about what's on the radar as well, or is that just are they trying to run us down a detour here? What do you think?
I don't know enough about, you know, I'm not familiar with what they've been doing with their endowment. I mean, the Gates Foundation is interesting, or one of the reasons it's interesting is, it really does show up the truth behind the philanthropic model here in the United States. You sweep a whole bunch of capital into an endowment, and that endowment doesn't have to pay taxes because it's supposedly for good works. So let's say it would pay taxes of 10% or 15% on its capital gains, but let's say based on the current principal and investment policy, it would have to pay taxes of 8% a year. Instead of paying taxes of 8% a year, we instead put it in a foundation, and then it gives the foundation 5% a year, so we avoid, you know, we basically save 3% a year. And what we do with the money that's in the endowment is we use it to finance the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
Okay? And so it provides cheaper capital for the military-industrial complex, and then we use our 5% to do a series of things which promote where we want to go and the people we want to manage and the things we want to do. And it also takes all the people concerned with what the military-industrial complex is doing and channels them in a way that keeps them very busy and out of our hair. And it's quite economic because it lowers the cost of capital to the military-industrial complex, and it takes the money we would have paid to pay taxes and government service and serves a whole variety of different agendas which serve our purpose.
Yeah.
And so there was a marvelous series that the Los Angeles Times did about the Gates Foundation financing the corporations that were destroying the environment in a place in Africa while the Gates Foundation was going in with a grant and saying, we are here to help you.
Exactly.
And pointing out the but, you know, not to pick on the Gates Foundation, because you'll throughout American philanthropy, you will see the same model. The universities here have been used as major ways of pooling capital for a variety of purposes. And when you look at what the university endowments are really doing and what's really going on, versus the notion that they would have tax shelter to basically, you know, plunder and destroy the world is quite amazing. There's a wonderful series of articles and transparency around the involvement of the Harvard Endowment in helping to basically rape Russia during the 90s, and there was even litigation around it. And, you know, it just goes to show you why in the world should we give a tax exemption to a university, which is really an air cover for an investment syndicate that is basically running around and killing people.
That's just incredible. And speaking of killing people, I mean, there are a few researchers out there who not only suggest that the flu is actually not the danger here, the vaccine is. And what do you think is the agenda with the swine flu vaccination program? Is it to kill off people, or are we talking about depopulation here?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of different hypotheses. And I don't, you know, I don't think we have the information to know. What I will tell you is, if you add up 20 different things in healthcare that we see here in North America, so you add up chemicals in the food and pasteurization of the food and all sorts of things done in the name of food safety and the industrialization of agriculture and the fluoridation of water and vaccines and what was done with anthrax in the Gulf War and AIDS and the evidence that that was biological warfare and Lyme disease and chronic fatigue and, you know, on and on and on. It's literally hundreds of things. And you study the behavior of the government and the regulators and the corporations and all of that stuff. When you step back and what you look at is there is no plan. How can I say this? There is a tremendous effort to do things that increase the toxicity levels of the population in general and lower the immune systems.
Yeah.
And it is intentional. It is a plan. It is not an accident.
And even the economic situation on top of that creates a lot of stress, of course, which, you know, we know how that affects the body as well, you know?
Well, you're seeing a system here in the United States where you have massive intervention intentionally to reduce the quality of health, and then massive intervention to help people deal and struggle with that, with those health problems. And one of the reasons the expense is so great is, for example, let's just take you and your family. Let's say I'm doing a variety of very time-intensive and expensive things to destroy your health of you and your family. I'm spraying chemtrails over your head. I'm putting fluoride in your water. I'm making sure your food goes 2,000 miles and is all very processed and you don't grow your own garden. And that's all very time-consuming and expensive. But then I'm making sure very expensive health care is available to you to, you know, so when you get cancer, we have chemotherapy. And, you know, think of it, one way to think about it is that it creates massive amount of employment where none
exists. Jeez.
Because we don't need hundreds of people doing all those things.
Yeah.
You know, we need to simplify, and then of course the question is, what do you do with all those people?
Yeah.
And how do all those corporations now make money now that we don't need all of that stuff?
It's just
so
amazing.
It's kind of a,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a false complexity.
Hmm. So the situation we're in is I mean, I've always said that we need to have a kind of a new industry popping up or whatever. You know, again, why don't we begin to phase out oil, for instance, and begin to invest in new types of energy? I mean, I think that there's a whole new industry that eventually this is going to pop up. But if right now it feels like we're in this rut, as you say, in between two different worlds almost, and we've kind of painted ourselves into the corner right now, it seems like.
Well, if you look at control, let's just step back and look at control from the point of view. Let's just invent a character called Mr. Global. And it's Mr. Global's job to manage the planet and manage all resources on the planet. And let's look at things from Mr. Global's point of view. Mr. Global, from what we can tell, wants control.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And the goal is control, not money, because we know if we just said, look, we want to optimize total wealth on planet Earth, and total wealth would be 100% fully optimized, my bet on how much wealth exists on planet Earth is less than 1% of that.
Mm.
And if you look at, well, why is it less than 1% of what could be 100%? It's because it's designed for control. It's not designed to optimize wealth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then what Mr. Global wants is control. Now, one of the chief ways that Mr. Global controls is by controlling the currencies. Okay?
Mm.
If you can control the currency and the monetary policy of a planet, you can control that planet, and pretty invisibly. But to control the currency, you need to be able to control and make sure that the critical assets are traded in that currency. And to date, that critical asset has been oil.
Yeah.
Now, we know that the powers that be, or they certainly appear, to want to move to a one-world virtual currency. And if you're going to, and that's ultimate, I mean, talk about ultimate control. One-world virtual currency is control, because a virtual currency will allow you to control the data. And in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. So how are you going to do that? Well, for a variety of reasons, it doesn't look like oil is going to work. And I think, you know, the most psychotic, crazy thing we're watching on planet Earth is an effort to control the seed supply, to literally patent the seed supply so it can be under corporate control, and to entirely industrialize and centralize agriculture and food production and distribution. My guess is that the Gates Foundation is playing no small part in helping to do that. And I think that's because oil won't work to back a one-world virtual currency, but control of the seed, water, and food supply will.
Well, hey, listen, I remember this story about the global seed vault up here in Svalbard, closer to where we are at least, and the Gates Foundation is one of the major contributors to that project, actually.
Right. So, very amazing and interesting project, and I think anything we can bring, do to bring transparency to what is happening, would be good. And, to me, seed banking is a very important thing for all of us to be doing.
I've held this idea or theory that they're putting away the good genetic stock, so to speak, of seeds and bringing us the kind of Monsanto Terminator seed type of technology to us. And eventually something happens, climate changes on the planet or whatever have you. We're going to end up in a situation where we don't have access to seeds that have a good variety of genetics, meaning that they will die quickly and of course, terminate and will not continue. That's a major food problem right there.
Right. My bet on a lot of the philanthropic effort is really to support the industrialization of agriculture. There is a wonderful video that you can get on YouTube, and I have it up on my blog, of Charlie Rose of Bloomberg interviewing Sir James Goldsmith in 1994, and it's absolutely brilliant. You absolutely should get a copy of it and watch it. Sir James Goldsmith basically describes what's going to happen to agriculture with the World Trade Organization and the Uruguay Round of GATT passing, and what the implementation is going to do worldwide to agriculture, and how incredibly insane the whole thing is.
Mm.
And his brilliance in understanding what was going to happen and why and warning people was phenomenal. And that interview in 1994 is just as powerful and useful today as it was then. And I strongly recommend, because what it says is, what it tells you is, we know, we understand what we're doing. This is clear. This is a plan. And this is very, very dangerous.
So where do you see Mr. Global taking America, financially speaking?
Well, Mr. Global, I think you need to look at it on a global basis. If you listen to Sir James Goldsmith and you look at everything that Mr. Global is doing, the only thing I can discern is Mr. Global plans on a much reduced population 20, 30, 40 years from now. And the, you know, how and why, the details of that, I have no idea. But if you look at the decisions that the American government started to make in 1995 and 96, a decision was made to literally pull all the capital out of the country, reinvest it in the emerging markets, particularly the BRIC nations, and to do that in a way that not only pulled all the capital that could be pulled legally, but pull a great deal illegally, and the way to do that politically was to pump and dump the economy with massive amounts of debt. And I was part of a group in Washington that was trying to argue for a model that would not, that, you know, that would support the transition of the baby boomer and the American population for globalization and into a successful retirement. And as I watched the event unfold and what decisions were made, I could only presume that they were planning on a significantly reduced population here in North America. Their actions could only be compatible with that kind of estimate actuarially for the United States population. And I tried desperately through the late 90s and, well, you know, for the last 15 years to try and warn family, friends. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience because literally there was almost no one who could fathom what I was trying to say. They could not fathom, literally the baby boomer population here in America could not fathom that their retirement savings and the resources behind governmental commitments to them was being moved out from under them, and they couldn't see it.
I do want to ask you a little bit about what you think about the whole issue that taxpayers have been bailing out the bankers, and if there's something you can say about that, and also what you think the outcome of this will be, because what I'm seeing a little bit of here as well is that we might end up in a situation where the population are going to demand almost a more kind of socialist approach to how we deal with the banks. What do you think about that?
Well, what I think of this as a country leverage buyout. Okay, and when you do a leverage buyout, or what we call an LBO of a company, you tender to get control of that company, and once you have control, you use the company's cash to pay back the money you borrowed to take over the company. So you buy the company with its own resources, okay, and it's called an LBO.
Right.
And what you've watched is an LBO of the United States, because massive amounts of fraudulent paper was issued during the 90s and early 2000. And that issuance wasn't an accident or incompetence or anything. There was massive intentional criminal fraud. It was a plan, and I have written many stories to sort of document why I say that. But it was enormously profitable, and, of course, after the paper was all issued, then the question became, because you have all these fraudulent mortgages issued, where either they're mortgages issued for people who can't possibly pay the debt service, or on one home we've issued, you know, one mortgage and nine fraudulent mortgages on the same house. So you have all this phony baloney paper floating around, And once the debt service can't be supported, the question is what happens? Well, in 1989, the last time this happened, what happened was all the paper was allowed to come in and was worked out by a variety of methods. But that meant the files on the paper would transfer to third parties and their attorneys, and a variety of people could see those files. And it started to become a big joke in Washington because we would see a variety of firms get together and bid significantly more than the loans were worth. And what we started to believe was, well, they need to own the files because there's so much criminal liability in those files, they can't afford for anybody to see the files. They're willing to pay, let's say the mortgages are worth, you know, $2, they're willing to pay $3 because getting and destroying the files is worth another dollar to them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this time around, rather than let anybody see the files, what we've seen is basically the government has literally just cut massive checks, and the institutions, you know, the files have quietly gone away, remained under control of the, you know, the parties who did the fraud, whatever.
Yeah.
And so there's no, you know, there's zero transparency, and literally you're watching the nation cut a check to the people who engineered the fraud to buy up the nation.
Yes.
And so literally it's an LBO of a country.
Hmm. And what will the outcome of that be? How will that affect people in the country?
Well, you now have it took from the Revolutionary War, 1776, until 3 years ago to accumulate $12 trillion of national debt. And then in the last year and a half, we incurred through the Fed or the Treasury another $12 trillion of debt to bail out the banks.
Hmm.
Now, one way to look at that system-wide is we took the entire savings of the baby boom generation and in a year and a half simply transferred it to the banks. And so now what we have is a huge cohort of people who think they have pensions and 401ks and health care insurance from the government when they're 65, or now, you know, if they're on welfare. And what is a process is now going to begin through a variety of different mechanisms whereby, you know, they end up with one-tenth of what they thought they had 3 years ago.
Hmm.
And it won't necessarily be that clear or that visible to them in an explicit way, but I think intuitively they understand the gist of what's happening to them.
Hmm.
And what you're seeing around the country now is sort of an awakening of the sleeping giant that this could really happen. For example, I remember once I was talking with someone in my family trying to warn them of this danger, and they said to me, oh, well, you know, there's always been corruption. It's just the nature of the system. Because America traditionally has been very dependent on warfare and organized crime to both pool capital and exercise control of natural resources around the world. And so Americans are used to, you know, corruption being part of the system, but they've always thought of that system as protective of them and their rights.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they didn't understand, you know, and my theory was, look, when you go along with the system doing this level of harm to people worldwide, then at some point that machinery you build that feels comfortable harming people will come back and steal it from you.
Right, right.
Mm. Right. So to a certain extent, we're living with the karma, you know, of having supported a machinery that's been doing this to people worldwide.
Yeah.
And the machinery has now decided to eat us.
That is really, you know, scary in one way, because what I wanted to ask you is also, are people just numb to the corruption? Because the question is, where's the anger from the people here? You know, it should be raiding, you know, Washington or the banks, or, you know, protest, outrage. But at the same time, I feel that that's might even be one of the outcomes that they do want to have. That will be another reason to instigate more control that you mentioned previously, right?
Well, the first thing to understand is the control in America has been very significant all along. In other words, probably one of the biggest job programs in America is, in the 70s, they called it COINTELPRO, but yeah. Surveillance and covert manipulation of the American people. And there have been thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people killed, poisoned, destroyed financially. You know, there is an invisible war that's been going on in America for decades, and it's one where, you know, many Americans have been assassinated, killed. It's just much more significant than people realize. And so America, living in America is a very, if you try and touch any of the power lines, it's very, very dangerous. So I don't know if you've seen the movie Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman.
Yes, I have.
It's a wonderful description of, you know, I always, I used to have people introduce me at conferences and say, this woman, you know, this is Catherine Austin Fitch. She played Will Smith in real life. And, you know, but, you know, Will Smith, it was, his situation was much faster. But it, you know, I went through a very, very similar process. And, you know, one of the things that was amazing was, you know, I had done to me pretty much almost everything Will Smith had done to him, although in a less dramatic form. And literally, there's no one you can go to. You know, there is no one in America who could help me. I remember I was very wealthy, and I tried to hire three private investigation firms, and each one of them came back and said, it's much too dangerous, we can't help you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then would teach me how to protect myself against biowarfare. And would describe to me the, you know, how I was going to be poisoned and how biowarfare was going to be used. And this wasn't me. I mean, these were experts saying, we won't work for you, it's too dangerous, but here's what we can teach you quickly about how to protect yourself. You know, anyway, so,
but
you, America...
You managed to pull through. You're still here, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one, you know, one of the ways I pulled through was over time, I gained access to lots of secret knowledge about healthcare and how to take care of yourself in these kinds of situations. And what was interesting to me, so I learned a tremendous amount about natural ways of improving your immune system and detoxifying, even from, you know, from low-level biowarfare and poisoning and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, found lots of people who've, you know, done and lived through the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the process, I ended up driving all around America and, in fact, to all 50 states. I ended up either driving or flying to Alaska and Hawaii. And what I saw stunned me. I had never realized it, would never have realized it, that I hadn't driven to so many different places. What you literally see is a population that's being poisoned.
Hmm.
There is, significant deterioration in immune systems and significant increase in population in toxicity levels. And I am always amazed when I go abroad. I used to go down to some conferences in Mexico, and the difference in the quality of health, physical health, between the Mexicans and the Americans was just shocking. So I think part of what Americans are struggling with are, 50 years of unbelievably unhealthy living.
Hmm. So the question here that arises, you know, if we take everything into account, what we've been talking about here, do you think that there will spring up alternatives? Do you think that people in the U.S., but not only there, worldwide, these are happening, I think, worldwide, different levels, of course, and at different speeds, as you mentioned, but... do you think that the people will find another way around these problems? Because really, there is no other alternative here.
Here is what needs to happen. The pro-centralization team has a plan, and they're off implementing their plan. And what is needed is for the pro-decentralization to find a way to meet each other and start to create alternatives and alternative visions and alternative actions.
Yes.
Now, that's happening all over the world. You know, wherever I go, whoever I talk to, people are sort of standing up and saying, you know, we need, you know, we need plan, we need to get off the Titanic, we need a lifeboat, you know, who can we get together with and build a lifeboat? Because,
yes,
you know, whatever we know, we want to get as far away from Mr. Global and his team as possible.
That's right.
And what has, what is happening, and the reason I jumped at the chance when you invited me to come on, is how do we find each other? How do we each do our own thing in our local area and in our networks, but
yes,
how do we network globally? Because in fact, they are few, we are many,
yeah, yeah,
but how do we become a we in a way that is energizing for us? Because, you know, part of being on the pro-decentralization team is we don't like to be part of centralized things.
Exactly. I see what you mean. It's a dilemma there and a problem. And at the same time, it's like whenever, although it's run by or have a good intention, so to speak, many organizations that pop up in groups and common interest, you know, unions and what have you, it is, seems to be the problem of going back to the COINTELPRO thing you mentioned before, infiltration, people coming in that are there to destroy things, which to me means that it must be a kind of an issue by issue basis that people agree over a common cause at that time and then kind of disperse again and do their thing locally, so to speak. But that when the issue is there and when it's needed, then people come together under the umbrella of that issue. That's at least how I view at it at this time.
Well, I think the first thing we all need, you know, what the we need is we need to understand there is a tapeworm, and that tapeworm is basically got a psychotic plan in mind.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's number one. And number two, we've got to get it in our heads. The tapeworm spends a fortune to buy us up and keep us channeled and keep us fighting with each other.
Yeah, that's right.
And we need to see that game and find ways of developing immunity to that game, because we don't need to waste our time sort of buying into their dead end solutions. So that's number, you know, so number one is see the tapeworm. Number two is see the tapeworm's game to trick us. And number three, simply find ways of self-organizing, but then teaming up as it is energizing for us through a variety of different formal and mostly informal networks. Because the more we can be, I promote something called Solari Circles, which is a small group of people getting together, and it's essentially a financial action club. And what I say to people is, look, don't worry about if there is a, you know, if Mr. Global has a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one.
Conspire in a good way. I see what you mean. Yeah, of course.
Oh, well, listen, on Wall Street in Washington, everything. What a conspiracy is, a group of people getting together and acting in concert for a particular end. And most conspiracies,
well, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience, conspiracies are the primary process by which anything gets done in this world. And that's not in any way to say that they're necessarily unethical or illegal. It's just, you know, a group of people get together, they make a plan, they coordinate through the spirit. It's their consensus. It's
yes,
their intention. They create a field, okay?
Mm.
So think of a conspiracy as a mini field. and you know, and that's how most things get done. And so, you know, economically, when it comes to somebody's finance, if you are, wherever you are on the planet, you are, there is a tapeworm trying to steal your money and trying to steal your resources. And you are living in the middle of a battle zone. And that means if you're going to protect your money or grow your money in a way that builds real wealth and changes the investment model here on planet Earth, then you need to be part of a conspiracy, because you cannot do that alone.
No, it's that's just, right. That's right.
But at the same time, I think we need small, informal, self-organizing groups. So, you know, I think one of the reasons the word conspiracy has been trashed so much is to try and discourage the general population from getting good at starting and running conspiracies for their own self. No, seriously.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's I get you. I get you. Absolutely. We need to conspire against those who are conspiring against us in that sense, you know?
Well, but I think we need to conspire. The people who are managing the planet are not competent to do it. They're very smart. They have enough technology to blow up the world 50 times over.
Hmm.
So I'm not saying they're not clever, but they're not competent to govern. And
yeah,
literally,
right.
The adults need to take back. And we have a responsibility. you know, to ourselves, to the next generations, to the, you know, I'm a Christian, so I would say the God who loves us, we have a responsibility to assert adult supervision of the planet.
Yeah, that's right.
And the question is, you know, if we're all organized into small self-organizing groups, how we can network to do that? And I think we can. It's simply a matter of seeing the need to do it and setting the attention. And then we go from here.
Absolutely. I think that that's very, very good tips that you've mentioned to us here. And one thing I'd like to do here before we begin to run things off is take all of this in a little bit of a different detour, because we've actually had one of our listeners contact us and who had heard you earlier this year on another radio program and wanted me to ask you a little bit about how about the idea that you found out about insider trading that pointed to the foreknowledge of the tsunami in Sumatra on Boxing Day back in 2004, and even the earthquakes in China back in 2006. Don't know if you want to just talk a little bit about that and how you found that out, because that is really interesting and has some huge implications, actually.
Well, I don't know other than what I experienced. What happened to me was a friend of mine wanted a world bond fund, and I'm not a big fan of world bond funds. And I spent a month researching different world bond funds and finally found two that kind of, you know, I was comfortable with. And they researched anyway. So they invested in one of them, and it had about 15% of the paper in Indonesian sovereign debt. And then right after they took a big position in it, overnight it dropped 15%. And there was no change in interest rates. There was nothing, there was no financial market reason, and we would call this, you know, they and I called the sponsor. We couldn't get any answers. No one would talk to us. It was just, we were being stonewalled. And it had all the patterns, as someone who's lived in the financial markets for decades, it just had the pattern. It was of massive insider selling on insider knowledge. And I was baffled. It was just one of the most baffling things that had ever happened. What in the world was this about? And then about a week after, the tsunami happened. I'll never forget it. I've never been, as a financial person, as an investment person, I've never been as depressed in my life, because my gut reaction was they knew the tsunami was coming. They knew. How could they have known? And I just, that's when I put together my first Solari Circle, and I said to everybody, we do it by bridge call once a week and, you know, help each other. We invest a little pool of capital together. And I said to the group when we gathered, I said, I cannot do this alone. I cannot do portfolio strategy in a world where people have foreknowledge of a tsunami hitting a country enough to affect its sovereign debt. Now, I have no proof that that's the case. You know, I could no more prove that in a court of law. It was just my gut reaction. You know, I've seen a lot of insider trading in my life, and a lot of insider trading patterns, both as a regulator for the government and as a Wall Streeter.
Yeah.
And, and it's part of mapping the financial ecosystems. I mean, I'll never forget when Paul Wellstone's plane was shot, it was crashed. And, if you look at the trading in the defense stocks, because his vote was the big block in the arms committee.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at how the stock shot up, so again, this mapping your financial ecosystems will tell you a lot. And if you look at the financial patterns around a lot of these events, you will see patterns that indicate or symptomatic of foreknowledge. Now, that's not legal proof that foreknowledge exists, but it's in my world as an investment person, it's enough to give you the information you need to act, you know, in the real world, because we have to act with the knowledge that we have. So I can't say much more about it other than if you look at the patterns around the earthquake in China, there's a lot of allegations kind of swirling around that we have the ability to induce those things. I believe
yes.
that invisible weaponry exists. And unfortunately, if you look at the financial patterns, to me, they argued, you know, that the tapeworm needed an event to keep the slow burn going.
Huh. So, as you say, either this is evidence for manufactured accident or disaster, so to speak, through some kind of technology, or it could also mean that they have some kind of detection technology that actually can track this much better than we're allowed to know about. Any gut feeling that feels more right to you on that, on those two issues?
Well, but here's how you look at it. Dick Cheney once said the deficits don't matter. And he was right, because what you're seeing in America is you're seeing a global taxation system. America prints treasury securities and paper currency, and then countries buy it, and then it goes down in value, mm-hmm. or fraudulent securities.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've created is a global taxation system. The legislatures in different countries aren't voting to pay a tax and then paying it. It's happening through the balance sheet, so it never has to go through the legal process with any sovereign government. But we basically we create paper that goes down in value, and other people take it. And that's how the empire is financed, and it's simply a global taxation system. But a global taxation system of that nature depends on force. Why would somebody take paper and watch it go down in value, you know, in a way that is in essence a significant billions of dollars of tax every year? Well, they would do that because they have to. And so, the fact that we have a global satellite system and global surveillance and nuclear bombs, and the Bush administration was working on a policy that would allow us to proactively drop a nuclear bomb and be able to survive the first response, you know, that's the kind of force you need to require globally, mm-hmm. nations around the world to buy and lose money on phony baloney paper. And so ultimately, we're watching a system where the value of all the paper comes out of the end of a gun, and an entire network of both covert and overt ability to force. And my suspicion is a lot of it works out of the satellite systems and the intelligence systems that allow us to kind of track what everybody's doing globally. There's a wonderful movie that sort of demonstrates how this all works, and how the economic system dovetails with the military force invisibly, and that's George Clooney's wonderful movie Syriana.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of the things we do on the Solari Report is we have a segment called Let's Go to the Movies, because in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact.
Hmm.
So I use the movies to help people understand how the economic model works. And Syriana is a beautiful example of why Dick Cheney probably said deficits don't matter.
So also to kind of tie it up together with what we talked about here with different, you know, technologies or what they're actually doing in regards to these tsunamis and foreknowledge and so forth, are you saying that the gun here in this case that you mentioned is the threat of some kind of natural disaster that the leaders or authority in that country that are being targeted actually know about, that, okay, we're actually going to do this to you now, and then they do it? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Well, what is the nature and state of the invisible weaponry? If you look at when Secretary Cullen was Secretary of Defense, he was quoted at a conference on these issues of saying, you know, this kind of technology, electromagnetic weaponry and other weaponry that could look like natural disasters existed. But the information is very thin on what the nature of invisible weaponry, like weather control and electromagnetic weaponry, and or the use of small nukes to do something like a tsunami, and there's a variety of different speculation about them, but we don't have good information. What we do know is that literally there was a process in the United States, starting with the National Security Act in 1947 and then the CIA Act in 1949, to create something called the Black Budget. And literally trillions of dollars have been funneled out of out of the governmental budgets and through organized crime activities with the help of the government, narcotics trafficking being a big one, we've had massive funding of corporations, large corporations, developing incredible technology. For example, we know that the Nazis had, had the beginnings of UFO technology, and that was brought back after the war as part of this funding.
Yes.
And there's been various sort of videotapes and interviews and conferences with generals, admirals, very significant military leadership who have testified and documented that literally the government lost control of the technology. We have this whole world of black technology, which has ended up, basically being owned and controlled by large corporations, but still financed by the government. So we have a governmental funding mechanism, but it's all this technology has gone black, and our biggest governance problem here in the United States is the government doesn't control this technology. And we've heard stories, all sorts of reports of presidents, Jimmy Carter getting elected and trying to get access to the knowledge and being told he doesn't have clearance.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
so we literally, the most powerful technology in the world, including being used for surveillance, including being used for covert and overt warfare and space travel and all sorts of high-tech functions. We we're all paying for it, but we don't have transparency about it. We don't understand it.
Yeah.
And it's going to the benefit of a small group of players who more and more from watching events are in control without our permission and without our understanding.
Absolutely, but we're getting in on the game, so to speak, a little bit. We're starting to unravel some of this stuff, and more information is coming out all the time. And just as you mentioned before, there's no reason to kind of feel depressed about these issues. This is all stuff that is going to, I think, lead us eventually to a situation where we actually work together on certain issues and to help each other out. And I hope that all these kind of negative scenarios that we've been discussing here today actually lead to something positive in the end. Is that where you're at right now as well, Catherine?
Yeah, what's so funny to me is as soon as you go through the process of facing, we have a group of people who are quite, we have a culture that is really, that has taken over, that is quite different from most of ours. And as soon as we see it for what it is, we understand what's going on, we understand the risks. As soon as we have a new framework for viewing what's going on in planet Earth, you have the knowledge to really see the game and how the game works, the average person is being so drained by thinking the game is one thing and constantly getting tricked, their money getting inflated, losing here in the United States massive amounts of, we're losing our time and we're losing our money because we don't see the game. As soon as we can see the game and we can see how to protect ourselves and our assets and our family in the game, then everything shifts. So it's worth going through the pain of facing a lot of these black things because you come out the other side and suddenly you're in a much better position to navigate your environment. So as depressing as it can be to face the game, I think the rewards and the opportunities are extraordinary if a critical mass of us globally can do so and start to sort of connect and organize. So God bless you for what you're doing with your show.
Thank you. And the same to you, Catherine. I know that you're very busy and we only have about 1 hour here today. So we'll round things up on this note here for this time. And I want to mention the website again, Solari.com. Check out the Solari report and Catherine's blog for much more. If there's anything you want to mention before we end, please go ahead. But thank you very much for coming on the program, Catherine, and keep up the great work.
The only one thing I should mention is what the question I get the most is, what can I do? And one of the things that's important to understand is that every one of us can create a positive intention, and whether it's pray or meditate or just create mental faith in that direction, it has an enormous effect on the consciousness of the planet. So no matter how busy you are, you know, you can do that while you're driving the car or cleaning your home or washing the dog or mowing your lawn.
Yeah.
And it will have a profound impact. So there's something very positive each one of us can do. It won't take more of our time or put any of us at risk, but just pray and meditate and hold the intention for that very positive direction.
Absolutely. Very good recommendation. Absolutely. Thank you very much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you're not yet a member, sign up and tune in. We have much more radio available for you on a wide variety of subjects. We have films, webcasts, and video interviews as well. We'll be back on Thursday with another program. Check out our upcoming guests in our radio archive. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. Take good care, and we'll be back soon.